This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero or the Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Welcome to episode 60 of Art Not Science. My name is Orissa Keane, and I'm the Writing and Publications Coordinator for the Physics Room. In this episode, we continue on from episode 57 with the remaining readings from Correspondence 3.1, conversations about the weather can no longer be regarded as small talk. Correspondence is a biannual tabloid publishing works for the page, ear, and web as openings into artistic practices and relationships. This issue contains contributions which address making art during a climate emergency, with a particular focus on material matters. Tonight you will be listening to Hana Pera Oaki reading Meeting the Lake and Honey Brown reading Non-Human Others and Kaupapa Māori Research by Te Kawiho Hoskins and Alison Jones. Working from a Kaupapa Māori foundation, Te Kawiho and Alison attempt in this chapter to engage their research more directly in consultation with non-human entities, consulting Hongi Hekasmoko on the 1819 Kerikeri land deed, and focusing on what the moko mark itself might have to communicate. Writing an acknowledgement of the essay, Hana reflects on the clarity and generosity of Te Kawiho and Alison's words. Non-Human Others in Kaupapa Māori Research was originally published in Critical Conversations in Kaupapa Māori in 2017 by Huia Publishers. We thank Huia and the authors for their permission to republish an extract in Correspondence 3.1. Here is Hana Pera Oaki reading their essay, Meeting the Lake.
Meeting the Lake by Hana Pera Oaki. The first time I read Non-Human Others and Kaupapa Māori Research by Te Kawiho Hoskins and Alison Jones, it was a green light moment. I remember furiously sticking post-it notes on so many of its passages. It articulated so much of the dissonance I had felt reading Rosie Braidotti, Bruno Latour, and even Donna J. Haraway. It wasn't necessarily that I disagreed with these philosophers, nor did I struggle to understand their sometimes frustratingly overcooked understanding of being in relation or of the interconnections that exist between other forms of life and matter that are around us. It was that it felt familiar, yet I could not express why, and the more I read, the more I felt that language used by many of the post-human and ecological philosophies was inadequate at describing these complexities. I have returned to this text a number of times and have even studied the endnotes and footnotes which have introduced me to new thinkers and has continued to feed my intellectual curiosity for years. It has deeply informed so much of the trajectory of my work as an artist and as a writer. It's rich and generous, and it feels important to acknowledge how indebted I am to these authors. Whenever I reread this text, I find myself particularly drawn to excerpts describing the Māori exchange of hou and the difficulty and impossibility of adequate translation of Te Reo Māori kupu into English. For instance, words in Te Reo Māori are not merely words, but are entire conceptions of how we, Māori, understand the world. A world like whakapapa cannot be understood as just genealogy, when it encompasses all life that exists and has ever existed and that will ever exist, and cannot be bound to Western ontologies of linear time. Translation is so important because we know from our history that certain words are not translated with care, such as when the missionary Henry Williams translated Te Tiriti o Waitangi into English overnight. We now know that there is a huge difference in meaning between kawanatanga and tino rangatiratanga. In this text, Hoskins and Jones interrogate both the Māori ontological understanding of Māori, mana, and wairua, and the agency of the non-human. Alongside that of a land deed signed by the Ngāpuhi rangatira, Hongi Hika. As a child, I spent a lot of time on Hika's whenua, visiting my grandparents, who often took us for ice cream by the stone store. There is a ridge above the stone store that was Kororipo Pa, now a historic walking path. I once ran it with my younger cousins to help them train for their school cross country. In 1814, Hika travelled to Sydney with his nephew Ruatara and Thomas Kendall, a missionary and arms dealer who had befriended Hika. Once in Sydney, they met the missionary Samuel Marsden and invited him to move to their territory and establish the first Anglican mission in New Zealand. Hika, who belonged to the hapu Ngā Te Rehua, signed a land deed for 13,000 acres that later became kirikiri by signing his mata ora in 1819. By signing his mata ora, he was not just signing his face, but the living face or the face of well-being marked on his body to connect him with his ancestors, both those who had passed and those yet to come. By making these marks on paper, a dead tree, also an ancestor, which is remade into paper, Hika inscribed the essence of his life force, the ihi, wihi, and wana of his being. Why on earth would he sign away this land from his people and thereby permanently alienate them from the land? No Māori rangatira would do this. It's completely untenable. Therefore, this cannot be regarded as a land deed in the European sense of the word, but rather as an exchange of breath, a ho, a promise, a living testament to the complexities within the relationship forged between Māori and Pākehā in the 19th century. What, of course, complicates this narrative of bicultural harmony is what came next, which was not just both the signing of He Whakaputanga in 1835 and Te Tiriti o Waitangi in 1840, but the musket wars led predominantly by figures like Hika. When visiting Australia in 1814, Hika had studied European farming and had also started to grow much easier crops, such as the potato, and could therefore provide greater sustenance to his people. Hika had also made careful notes of European military techniques and purchased a number of muskets. It was the accumulation of these muskets that resulted in Hika being able to carry out a number of attacks on other iwi all around the country, including kidnapping some of my Ngāti Mahuta ancestors and massacring some of my Te Arawa whanaunga near Lake Rotuiti using Te Ara or Hene Hopu track, commonly referred to as Hongi's track. While rereading this text, I cannot help but think about the actions of Hika, whose exchanges made with Pākehā introduced technologies that vastly impacted upon so many other Māori communities. For better or worse, these actions changed the course of history across this land. As researchers and collaborators, Hoskins and Jones have a methodology for writing together that can be described as embodying the Māori Pākehā hyphen, which acts as a way of learning, understanding, and exchanging hō. It presents the best possible way forward for Māori and Pākehā, a way of meeting in the middle, Waina Nui. Both authors admit it's messy where they write as an endnote. This is a complicated assertion. Our individual identities are far more fluid than the simple dualism, settler, indigenous, suggests. Te Kawahau is a scholar in the Western Academy, for instance. Alison is a Pākehā who defines her cultural identity in relation to and with Māori. When you exchange hongi, you infuse your life force with another. In a deeper sense, it's an acknowledgement of the ways in which human beings are entangled with forces and beings that exist within the world that cannot be neatly categorized into a Cartesian split or be seen simply as hyphen. When Māori introduce themselves to one another, we describe ourselves as being a river, mountain, an entire tribe or ancestor. Ko au te awa, ko te awa ko au. I am the river and the river is me. When I speak to the rivers I belong to, I describe them as being a part of me in the literal sense. It is a way of understanding the world which has offered a creative approach to the interpretation of New Zealand law, which resulted in New Zealand passing a law granting legal personhood status to the Whanganui River in 2017. This law decrees that the river is a wholly living entity from the mountain to the sea. It incorporates both physical and metaphysical elements of the river. This particular legal approach has set an international precedent that has been followed by some other countries, including Bangladesh, which in 2019 granted all its rivers the same rights as people. This is perhaps an example of the ways in which Māori and Indigenous people around the world, especially in the so-called Global South, understand the rights and responsibilities they have to the non-human entities that exist around us. In the footnotes, an example Hoskins and Jones cite is that of the late Anishinaabe or Chupoi thinker Wabe Kanyu, where he wrote in his treatise, "We have the right to exist," a translation of Aboriginal Indigenous thought, the first book ever published from an Anishinaabe or Chupoi perspective, that a person meets the lake rather than goes to get water. These beings and ideas of how to live with the non-human, whether it is a building, a taonga, pounamu, a tree, a river, or lichen, cannot be understood as having simply thingness. It's much bigger than that, nor can it be understood as something that can be owned in the capitalist understanding of exchange. Sharing hō cannot equal the alienation of land forever in the form of a land deed, even if the stone store is built on top of it. We can only live in kinship with these forces and understand that they need to be cared for and respected as part of the whakapapa of all beings that exist, have existed, and will continue to exist long after we leave this world.
That was Hana Pera Oaki reading Meeting the Lake. Next up, you'll hear Honey Brown reading an extract from Non-Human Others in Kaupapa Māori Research by Te Kawehau Hoskins and Alison Jones.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Non-Human Others and Kaupapa Māori Research, Te Kawehau Hoskins and Alison Jones. Māori constantly evoke relational ontologies and recognise that the non-human world has agency. That is, Māori take for granted that the material things of the world, whether a forest, a lake, or a building, can speak to human beings. We are always already in relation with certain material objects, and yet Kaupapa Māori researchers and methodologies are relatively silent on the place of the material world and human-non-human relations in the framing of research. This chapter attempts to open the space through a kaupapa Māori ontological and methodological engagement with post-humanist theory, also known as new materialism, which seeks to consult non-humans more closely. In this case, we consult Hongihika's moko on the 1819 Kirikiri land deed, not as an artifact, but as a speaking subject, and rather than offering another interpretation of the moko as a signature, we instead listen for what it might have to say. This ink on paper mark played a significant role in the earliest Māori-Pākehā relationships in Aotearoa New Zealand. Hongihika of Ngāpuhi drew his moko on 4 November 1819 on the second New Zealand land deed. 13,000 acres of Kirikiri in the Bay of Islands sold to the Church Missionary Society for 48 axes. This mark, seen as a signature, is sometimes understood today as evidence of Hongihika having sold the land to Pākehā European purchasers. As a result of this sale, the land on which the town of Kirikiri now stands shifted permanently into Pākehā ownership. Many commentators have pointed out that the meaning of such land deeds from early 19th century New Zealand becomes very unclear when two languages and cultures are engaged in a transaction such as sale of land. Did Hongihika sell the land, permanently alienating it from himself and his people for a few tools? Such an act was impossible. Commentators have pointed to the language used in the early 19th century related to land transactions in particular, tuku and hoko. Tuku cannot be translated easily into English. It refers to a form of exchange enacted with ceremony under the authority of a rangatira, and which, at heart, is about forming and solidifying a relationship. Hoko is a simpler idea of exchange through trade. Discussion about the Treaty of Waitangi and the permissions it is seen to have granted alert us to these ideas. To quote a media henare, in Māori understandings, the treaty took the form of a chiefly gift exchange, ensuring the retention of Māori authority alongside British governorship, and alliance between tribal leaders and the Queen of England. In this document, two key terms were used to express the nature of the exchanges being agreed between the chiefs of Queen Victoria. The first was tuku, a term signifying the release of something important into the keeping of another, with the expectation of an ongoing relationship. The second important term in the treaty is hoko, a more prosaic mode of exchange, whereby transfers are effected without necessarily engendering a long-term relationship or obligation. As He Nare put it, as part of the treaty agreement, chiefs finally tukud to the queen te hokonga o era wahi wenua, the right to control the hokoing, selling, of land in New Zealand. He Nare is suggesting that although hoko might be understood more like sale in European terms, it was a form of exchange existing under the aegis of tuku, which is always and already relational, unlike a sale, which is an act of alienation. In Western critical social research, it is possible, even necessary, to argue that Hongihika's pen and ink moko on the land deed has many possible meanings. For instance, as his agreement that the Kirikiri land is sold and therefore alienated forever, the European view is the act of a naive native leader, going along with a peculiar European ritual of sale that he did not fully understand. As an artifact in the history of European land alienation and robbery, the act of a shrewd Māori strategist recruiting his Pākehā into his territory, binding them into a permanent alliance with his iwi. What can be said about this web of conflicting definitions? A kaupapa Māori sensibility dismisses the first meaning given the idea of tuku above. The second meaning would also be untenable, because it assumes that the great Hongihika was naive, and this meaning only operates if we agree that the deed's true meaning is the first one. The third and fourth meanings, given they position Māori as having been colonized, or on the other hand, as taking charge of a complex situation, could be taken up by Māori as possible readings of the moko signature on the land deed. In this chapter, we take a somewhat different approach again, still under the umbrella of what might be called kaupapa Māori theory. Rather than debate legitimate interpretations of the moko, we attempt to focus on the physicality of the moko signature on paper. It becomes a thing that might itself have something to say. We encounter the drawn moko, our object of study, as an organic speaking subject. Māori ontology. Such an encounter makes sense in the Māori ontological world within which the mark on paper was made. This world takes it for granted that objects can speak, act, and have effects independently of human thought and will. This ontology was developed in a particular context of knowing that was itself molded out of the problems of living, acting, and thinking in specific natural and social environments. Indigenous peoples, just as European peoples did before and outside the dominance of science, the Enlightenment, and the Church, engaged with an environment that was already formed by powerful and weak forces and objects, where human beings had to negotiate with capricious, live, natural world. Such everyday entanglement of nature and culture has produced lasting ontologies and epistemologies that identify humans in and with nature, and vice versa. This is easily observed today. Māori regularly engage in invocations that address and welcome, say the plants or the sea when food or other resources are collected. Such of Māori everyday life is shaped by awareness of the human-non-human dynamic. As humans, as Māori, constantly negotiate with the natural world, endeavouring to meet its dispositions and participate in its balances. It is widespread among Māori today to talk about a river, a mountain, an entire tribe, or an ancestor that lived hundreds of years ago as yourself. Ko o te awa, ko te awa ko o. I am the river and the river is me. This statement is not simply metaphor, but a deep visceral identification as the animated, embodied river, mountain, or ancestor. It remains common in Māori and other indigenous thinking for objects, whether hongihikas, tāmoko on paper, a dead body, a forest, or a piece of greenstone, to be understood as determining events, as exerting forces, as volitional, or as instructing people. In post-Enlightenment Western ontologies, objects such as tools and stones are typically experienced and known as inanimate matter. But for Indigenous peoples, the liveliness of matter is grasped as quite ordinary. Within a Māori ontological frame, all beings and objects are experienced as having mana, a form of presence and authority, and a vigour, impetus, and potentiality called Māori. Te Māori o te whenua, the life force of the land, o te Māori o te tāmoko o hongihika, the life force of hongihika's moko on the paper deed, are perfectly mundane ideas to Māori. Terms such as Māori and mana name the interconnectivity of the human and non-human worlds. So within a Māori ontological context, the moko on the land deed lives. It is alive. It is not something old, inert, flat on a page, but something present, vibrant, and lively. It is a taonga, a sacred object holding hongihika's presence, his mana, his authority, and chiefly power, co-present with the mana of his ancestors. His face and its embodied authority is before us. It encounters us. We are face to face with hongihika. His presence carries an invitation to engage te mihi, to speak greetings and make genealogical connections, to tangi, to remember and lament this dead relative and others, to hongi, to press noses and intermingle ho, breath, and a solemn enactment of a relationship, a joining of forces. These invitations by the moko assume and take seriously the idea that the object is animate, and therefore an active relationship with those who encounter it. In this sense, the object acts. It speaks, it makes demands, and it draws a response from us. Relationality. In calling forth a response, all beings and things have particular qualities and capabilities by virtue of their taking form in a relational context. The identity of things in the world is not understood as discrete or independent, but emerges through and relates to everything else. It is the relation or connection, not the thing itself, that is ontologically privileged in Indigenous and Māori thought. Indeed, the general term for Māori people, tangata whenua, refers literally to a land, earth, placenta, human. Each forms the other, so the vitality of things is possible not because of the intrinsic qualities of one object alone, but because of its relationship with the Māori, vigour, impetus, and potentiality of others. This ontology, or to use Solomon's useful phrase, ontological style, produces a relationship between all things, including human beings. Such a relational worldview is present in Māori research practice, which includes such elements as karakia, to invite non-human forces to enable the research to proceed well, to unfold forces, bodies, spaces, ancestors, earth, and sky, and productive engagement, mihi connections made to others and the earth place from which they come. Hungi, the pressing of noses and an exchange of breath that binds the parties together in a relationship of trust. Kai, sharing of food that both seals a relationship between researcher and participant, as they work together in research conversations, and because food is noa, non-sacred, it also counteracts the tapu or sacredness of the exchange of knowledge that is the basis of a research encounter. In other words, it is commonplace for Māori in the academy today to practice ontological understandings of the world and its ongoing processes of becoming. It is worth mentioning that these ontological practices are not only cultural but also political acts. The phrase kaupapa Māori provides an umbrella term for the critical decolonizing project that nurtures such theorizing and researching within the indigenous Māori ontologies and practices.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
The matter of language. It is interesting to note that some similar ontological moves are occurring within Western thought. Post-humanist or new materialist discussions in Western social analysis have turned to re-examine the material world. Theorists have critiqued the idea of the empirical as being understood as reality and radically separated from human apprehension of it. The argument that humans can only access reality through interpretation has become dominant in social sciences, including education, with the rise of interpretivism, constructivism, and discourse theories. Post-humanist critics of this linguistic turn in Western social science point out that the dominance of discourse has left the object world alienated from us. Philosopher of science Karen Barad, in Meeting the Universe Halfway, 2007, and others such as Jane Bennett in Vibrant Matter, A Political Ecology of Things, 2010, foreground the material, objects and things which they maintain, has been largely relegated to the shadows of modern social theory, but argue post-humanist theorists, data have their ways of making themselves intelligible to us. McClure, 2013. The material has agency and makes demands. It has, in Bennett's words, thing power. Some have pointed out that the position of objects behind discourse is embedded in the very logic of European languages, such as English. The usual logic of English grammar, object, passive, subject, active, reflects and reproduces as Western subject-object dualism, and the ontological assumption that nature-object is passive and cultural language is the source of active differentiation. So for instance, the simple descriptive statement that a shape is traced in ink, the shape represents the facial tattoo, is ontological in that it places the act of drawing and the act of representation between the inked shape, nature or object, and its author, culture or human actor. The ink is being traced, the tattoo is being represented. It becomes impossible on this dualistic logic for the ink to have modi, an energetic force, or the tattoo to be the force of a person. Method, how to proceed. How might we encounter thing power or the modi of Hungihika's moko mark? We must reach toward something that exceeds language, an attitude, a sympathy, a feeling, an openness. The moko image is so many things. An object, a text, an image, reproduced on the pages of this book and also inhabiting an 1819 land deed. The mana, authority, presence of a man and an iwi, a signature, a face, an object of exquisite aesthetic beauty. It is intensities of ink, interactions of shape and body, assemblages of paper, ho, and mana. The whole document is made of organic materials, paper and ink, with a wax seal. It provokes us in a multitude of ways. How do we find our openness? How do we make ourselves available to thing power, and vice versa? What research methods are suggested by Māori ontologies? Can the debates in post-humanism help with this question? It is remarkably difficult to find suggestions for method in the new debates. This may be because method is a human-centered activity, where we are being asked to center the object that would have been called data, an invitation to engage in interaction, seems as much about experience as method. Some new materialist theorists suggest that we proceed by giving special attention to matter, or that we move beyond discursive construction and grapple with materiality. What we, Ellison and Te Kawiho, find is that we, whether Western or Indigenous scholars, are always caught in our human-centeredness. When we grapple with matter and then express that engagement in writing, in this case in English, as the grapplees, matter remains necessarily dualistically the object of our attention. We feel stuck and uncertain about how to proceed. Maybe this does not matter. Maybe the provocation is to encounter uncertainly the object world. This suggests method as an ongoing struggle and as constant attempts at connection rather than a set of rules for procedure. The resulting written accounts will have the irritating or exhilarating characteristics of fluidity, contingency, ambiguity, and obscurity. That is the territory we are working in. A kaupapa Māori inflected research method opens us to a range of new terms, impressions, languages, expressive forms, and ways of seeing. Provocation. We would argue that such ideas might provide another provocation kaupapa Māori researchers could recognize in Bennett's work and others like her, something that makes sense within a Māori ontological approach to reality. She concludes her seminal book, Vibrant Matter, with a call to devise new ways of looking that enable us to consult non-humans more closely. She suggests we researchers encounter objects as they command attention from us. That is, objects require, demand, engage, and exist in a relationship with us and with other objects, but instead of being merely a product of that relationship, to be understood as interpretation, for example, debris or taonga. Objects simultaneously maintain their own singularity as thing, stoically outside our human encounter with them. Bennett seems to suggest that we turn to that thing outside and inquire of it, foregrounding the possibility that it might have something to say to us in the process of our consultation. How might the vitality of things such as Hungihika's signature or the Māori of his signature, which exceeds comprehensive grasp, be engaged? Bennett is persistent. She suggests a cultivated patient sensory attentiveness to non-human forces, an alertness to matter as vibrant, vital, energetic, lively, quivering, vibratory, evanescent, and effluescent, or as Masumi suggests, a sensitivity to the scent of a thingly power. These strange methodological suggestions remind us how radically difficult it is to write about matter's vibrancy, at least when we write in English. In Te Reo, the Māori language, we are not so limited. We have already mentioned terms such as Māori, Ho, and Mana that assume a liveliness of matter and a human-thing relationship. But it is not merely a matter of learning a few new words. In taking up these new terms, rich meanings, we are required to study their contextual meanings, their metaphorical fluidity, and their multi-layered ability to access the real. Such immersive study is an encounter with the intricacies in the object's murmurings, not heard at first. It still might be a struggle to express those inchoate meanings in writing and in the logic of a research article. But isn't this difficult work what kaupapa Māori is all about?
You've just been listening to Honey Brown reading Non-Human Others and Kaupapa Māori Research by Te Kawiho Hoskins and Alison Jones. And that's all for tonight. Thanks very much for listening to this final selection of readings from Correspondence 3.1. Pick up a copy from our gallery and a few other places around the motu listed on our website, or access the full publication online. Correspondence Issue 3.2 will be launching in July. This issue explores modes of resistance, action and solidarity opposing the genocide in Palestine, and features writing by Java Bentley, Ayla Collin and Juanita Heppi, photographs by Kata Newberry, and protest posters by Mengzu Fu and Huriana Kōpeke Tiaho. Check out the events page on our website, subscribe to our newsletter, or follow us on social media for more details. Currently showing at the Physics Room is Like a Broth, Like a Cure, with works by Aroha Novak, Shriwana Spong, and George Watson. The exhibition is about illness and remedy, grief and restoration as forms of inheritance.
The physics room is located at 301 Montreal Street and will be open Tuesday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. The show will run until July 14th. Thank you for listening. Ngā mihi o te wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.